Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Daytona State College and soon to be Oklahoma Christian University. I'm joined this week by Michael Baranowski as we tackle a busy week in politics. How are you doing, Michael?
I'm doing just fine. How about you, Trey?
I'm excited because we're on the precipice of moving, so this is a great
week. That's right.
Yeah,
there's always a lot going on, so not just in politics, but personally, so yeah.
Exactly. So it'll be a lot of fun. Soon I'll be on Central Time. But in kind of a more negative sense, not too far from where I'm going to be heading, Oklahoma, we have had kind of a really big tragedy yesterday where we had 10, mainly students, 10 people were killed Friday morning at a high school in southeast Texas by a student wielding a shotgun and a .38 revolver belonging to his father. The 17-year-old was, according to reports, shooting specifically at the people he did not like and sparing those he did to tell his story. Unlike other mass shooters, according to reports, he doesn't have the normal negative variables, the normal warning signs leading up to this. In addition to the weapons, he was also planning on and had Molotov cocktails and other explosives to kill and harm people. And so here we are with a shooting, Michael. You know, I feel like I'm saying this too much, but what do you think about that?
Well, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, we've talked about this far too many times, obviously. And, you know, I don't have a lot new to say. If after Las Vegas, if after Sandy Hook, if after all those sort of things, there wasn't going to be any sort of major legislative change, however you feel about that, negatively or positively, this certainly won't tilt things anyway. I mean, I guess I fall back onto this, is that in the United States, we have a gun culture, for better or for worse, and this is the price we pay for having a gun culture. And, you know, I certainly don't agree with it, but I also am under no illusions that this is anything that's going to magically change for the better anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, I come from a slightly different perspective, and, you know, we've talked about this in the past, obviously, before. And, you know, my kind of takeaway is I don't think the right or the left is being very empirical about this. I mean, at the end of the day, I think that these kinds of events, we talk about this in the political science literature as being agenda setting and priming. These are really tragic events and they get a lot of attention. But when you look at the absolute numbers, I don't think either Republicans or Democrats really want to face up to the fact that Republicans don't want to say, well, look, you look at other countries, we've got some empirical, you can bring the number of gun deaths down in a country, right? That's clear. And I think on the left, they don't want to be clear about that these are unusual events. The likelihood that any individual person is going to be involved in a mass shooting is 1 in 11,000. Yeah. And that just, you know, so, you know, we can, that number can get lower. But you have to put that in perspective when you have things like heart disease, cancer, accidents, ranking about 1 in 6. So I don't think the right wants to deal with the fact that we've got good empirical data that these numbers can be brought down lower. And I don't think liberals who want to continually say, well, look, we're having shootings every 2 seconds, want to recognize that your likelihood of being shot is still a really rare occurrence. It's just an agenda set item in the news.
Yeah, I think that's very, I mean, I agree entirely with that. I think it's very well put. And, you know, like with anything else in public policy, there are trade-offs involved. And at this point, we have decided, I mean, not all of us, obviously, but enough people have decided that they're not interested in making that trade-off, essentially. But you're right about the point on the left. I mean, we certainly have a mass shooting problem, but the true gun violence problem is focused on things like gun suicides and gun crimes and that sort of thing.
Exactly. But I think we have gone over that ground before for our listeners. And so I think we can say that, you know, we don't mean in only giving this a minute that this isn't an important issue. It's just something that we've dealt with. And again, coming from somebody, I lived right next to one last time we were talking about this in Parkland, Florida. It was difficult for me to talk about because this is my hometown, effectively. So, you know, don't take that as being, you know, us thinking anything less of the tragedy that this is.
Not at all. So, not at all.
But moving forward from that, from some local issues, let's take a look at I think probably the biggest story this week, Michael, is the Jerusalem embassy opening. For our listeners, the embassy on Monday was moved to Jerusalem, and it led to the bloodiest day in Gaza since the 2014 war with Israel, where Israeli security forces killed more than 50 Palestinians and injured another 2,400 during the Monday protests. The White House responded that the blame is with Hamas, the terrorist group that controls Gaza. Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, she defended the move and placed all the blame for the conflict with Hamas, saying, quote, "I ask my colleagues here in the Security Council, who among us would accept this type of activity on your border? No one," Haley would say. And it's interesting because one of the things that I think gets lost in this, Michael, is that the move to Jerusalem is not actually just a Trump move. As a matter of fact, the law that was going to move the embassy to Jerusalem happens in 1995 during the Clinton administration. And by huge margins, 93-5 in the Senate and 374-37 in the House, Jerusalem is recognized as the capital, and it required the embassy to be moved by 1999. Bill Clinton would neither sign nor veto the bill, but 10 days later, if you read the Constitution, that means it goes into effect. But what would end up happening is, starting in 1999, Clinton would use the waiver authority in the bill. Basically, presidents could delay moving the embassy for 6 months. And presidents ever since have used that authority to continue to delay it. And then, effectively, Trump on Monday stopped delaying it. And so now we've got this interesting set of circumstances going on. So, Michael, what do you think about, you know, there's questions of the Middle East peace process being done. There's talk about this being the right thing to do. You shouldn't keep waving this forever. Where do you fall?
Well, I think there are, as usual with most of Trump administration things, I guess I feel like there's a better and a worse way to do these things if you're going to do them. And the Trump administration, I think, once again, has picked the worst way. Like, for instance, you know, there was a reason why this was done on Monday. It was the 70th anniversary of Israel's founding. This is a huge day in Israel, obviously. It's also a huge day for Palestinians. They call it, the translation is the Day of Catastrophe, which you can understand why it would feel that way to Palestinians. So making that move in a very public sort of way on that particular day is basically just sticking a thumb in the eye of the Palestinians. Now, that to me is a clearly provocative gesture. Why do you do it that way? Well, you do that way because you're sending a signal. And to me, that signal is we are squarely on the side of Israel here, and we don't really care so much about the Palestinians. And I think the Trump administration has done that in a number of different ways. I think that the waiver should have been signed again under the Trump administration. But even if it wasn't, this wasn't the way to go about this. Now, that being said, though, Trey, I should say that, you know, this is difficult for me because Hamas is an awful organization. That they're reprehensible. And the way that they use, I feel like they've used many Palestinian folks who are, you know, suffering greatly. They've used them in, well, reprehensible ways. And so when it's what I see as some of these morally repugnant actions of the Israeli Defense Forces against morally repugnant actions of Hamas, I find it difficult to, this isn't a good guy, bad guy kind of thing, sort of. If Hamas were less awful, and then of course the response is, well, Hamas is so awful because they're responding to the horrific condition that the Palestinians have been put into in Gaza by the Israeli. And so it's just such a incredible mess. And I think that the Trump administration has just gone in and made a bad situation worse, as they are often seem to do.
You know, you're absolutely right on the front that this is a complex issue, and part of the problem is that in a fundamental level, compromise is impossible. And I don't mean impossible, so hear me in the right way. I don't mean impossible in the sense that, you know, you the two of us couldn't sit down and come to a position that was a compromise. But it's not possible for the people who are involved in the situation, because both of them are demanding the same location.
Yeah.
And both of them have a horrible historical backstory that puts them into the location that they're butting over. So I don't know, and I think for a long time presidents have gone in with this kind of these rose-colored glasses that they were somehow going to be the saviors of the of the Middle East crisis, as we've come to call it. And I don't think that there is a fix for this. So what do you do? And so in one sense, I can understand in a basic way why the Trump administration wants to finally just take a side, because I don't know how you broker peace in this circumstance. But I do deeply agree with your point that, you know, picking a side and poking your thumb in somebody's eye are two very different things.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think this is of a broader piece with the with how I believe Donald Trump and many of his administration see the world is in terms of zero-sum games, in terms of good guys and bad guys and so forth. And, you know, so and if you look at the general Middle East policy, well, Hamas is supported by Iran and Iran is our enemy. Hamas is our enemy. And certainly they're bad actors. But the way to do this, I do not think, is to just go all in with Israel here and expect that that's just going to help matters. I don't see how that doesn't make matters worse. If your concern is with terrorism and so forth, I don't see how this makes things any better. And oftentimes it's frustrating to me that the Trump administration's response to ambiguity is to just ignore it and to just say, well, we're going to do this. And that to me, that's just insane is too strong a word, but that's just incredibly counterproductive. And it may sound good on the campaign trail. It may sound good to crowds who don't understand the complexities of the situation, but it's not a rational adult response to an incredibly complex situation. And so, you know, I'm disappointed, obviously. And of course, you know, the U.S. move, now Guatemala's announced it's moving its embassy to Jerusalem. I believe Paraguay's announced recently that as well. A couple other countries are considering it. But, you know, still, it's kind of, aside from a few smaller countries, it's still pretty much the U.S. and Israel against the rest of the world. And as I've said before, when it's just us or us and a couple of countries against the rest of the world, I'm not saying that we're necessarily wrong, but maybe when that happens, we should step back and have a little bit of intellectual humility, ideological humility, and say, well, maybe we should consider why everyone else is against us. Is it everyone else is somehow wrong and we're right? Well, I guess that's possible, but, you know, it's worth giving a second thought to, I think.
I agree. And I think in these conversations, one of the things that's very difficult in the United States is that when you try to have rational conversations about this issue, you're immediately an anti-Semite. And we could probably talk about that for a while. But, you know, Haley basically says, like, look, who else is going to do this? I mean, I don't know about you, but if they're, you know, let's take an extreme Trumpian example and say that we saw drug dealers pouring across the southern border along with women and children. No, you know what? I'm still not going to be okay with mowing them all down.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of has kind of that part of the story has kind of gotten lost in the question here. I mean, a bunch of civilians are killed.
Yeah. But then, you know, on the other hand, you have countries whose avowed, you know, policy goal is to eradicate Israel as a state. that's pretty strong. So again, it's an incredibly complex situation with, I think, some very morally, ethically disturbing actors on all sides, which makes it difficult, I would say impossible, to take a side. And I really wish the Trump administration would had a more nuanced policy toward this.
I think what we're going to finally ultimately agree on is that the Trump administration doesn't like nuanced policies.
No,
because it doesn't fit into the number of characters necessary for Twitter.
There you go. Even with the expanded number, you still can't do nuance on Twitter. Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm not even sure. Maybe even a one-page paper would be a step up. But
if we could maybe get President Trump onto Facebook instead, you know, that might be a little more, I don't know, anyway.
Well, that's true. That's, you know, I had never thought about that. That's, maybe we should, maybe we could make a hashtag for that.
That would be a good one. Well, we'll have to keep that in mind.
In other foreign policy news, we may need to put President Trump's Nobel Peace Prize on hold. I know that you were holding it in readiness, Mike.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, right there.
We might need to put it on hold because comments from John Bolton have angered North Korea and potentially put the upcoming U.S.-North Korea summit in jeopardy. Bolton argued that North Korea needs to go on the Libya model. And North Korea has now threatened to cancel the summit if the U.S. continues to ask for full nuclear disarmament, something that we had actually talked about a couple of weeks ago. The White House brushed aside those threats and said they are still hopeful the meeting is going to happen. Trump, however, is fine if they don't, apparently. The White House simply sees this as North Korea trying to seek a tactical advantage in the run-up to the meeting, which is scheduled for June 12th in Singapore. President Trump said, quote, he will get protections that are very strong, end quote. Not that you really ever need to say it's Trump. You can just hear it in the quote.
Yeah, no,
in an attempt to kind of lure the North Korean leader into negotiating, but warned that there would be some severe consequences if he did not. So here we are again. We're once again talking about North Korea, but this time we're not talking about North and South. We're talking about the summit and a day. So what do you think about this, Michael?
Well, I think it fits with a broader pattern of, you know, North Korea issuing these sort of strong, strong statements and so forth. So I think probably there's a good chance it will go ahead. But the point about John Bolton, he should have known better, obviously, than to use the word Libya in anything involving North Korea, given what happened when Libya gave up its nuclear program and, you know, Gaddafi ended up, well, dead, essentially. And, you know, it doesn't matter what promises Donald Trump gives Kim, because Donald Trump has demonstrated on the international stage that his promises don't count for much of anything. And I think everyone knows that now, which is, again, why it's so frustrating for me to see his sort of short-term thinking. And it's not just one deal you're worried about. You have to think about the future. And I don't think he's very good at that. And so I don't necessarily think he has any nefarious intent. He doesn't want to start a war, I don't believe. But the way he's going about this is, you know, is troubling to me. It's certainly, I think it's counterproductive, you know. And again, that said, I think did what Donald Trump do bring Kim to the negotiating table? I think you can make a not unreasonable case for that. But I think also it's more the case that had any other administration been in power, they would have done sort of the same sort of sanctions related things had Kim done the same nuclear tests, and we'd kind of be at a similar point maybe. So that, I guess that's sort of how I am looking at this right now.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways I agree. I actually, on this front, I agree with the White House. The North Korea coming out right now, I mean, Bolton, you're absolutely right. That was a boneheaded thing to say. And specifically, I mean, Libya. I mean, why? Like, what? That's not a model for anything anyway. But that point aside, even had Bolton not said anything, I think it is very likely that the White House is right, that North Korea is trying to have a better tactical advantage here, because this is what they do. This is what they have done repeatedly.
Yep.
I mean, there are some things, and we talk about this, and we say, you know, it's difficult to predict the future. There's other times where you can say, yeah, I can tell you what's going to happen because it's happened before. It's going to happen again. And I think it's likely that this meeting is going to go down. But as we had talked about a couple of weeks ago, the idea that North Korea is going to unilaterally just give up all their arms is hovers somewhere around -1 on a scale of 0 to 10.
Yeah.
And I don't think even Donald Trump thinks that that's going to happen. So you're just having the jockeying of two guys before a big business meeting trying to decide who's going to come in with what kind of swagger.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I think even if these talks are ultimately disappointing to many people, which I think they probably will be, I believe there's something to be said for starting the process of talking, because unless you have that sort of dialogue, you're never going to get anywhere just with threats and sanctions alone, I don't think. And so I think this is an important part of it. I see this as what I hope to be a first step in a process that's almost certainly going to take, I would say, years, certainly. And the problem, I think, is that we're just so conditioned to expect everything to happen boom right away, whether it's, you know, a change in our relationship with North Korea or, let's say, an end to a special counsel investigation. We'll talk about that later, obviously. But I think, you know, that's a huge problem. These things are incredibly complex and take a lot of time, and we need to be patient. And patience is something that oftentimes is lacking both in the media and, I would say, in the administration, starting at the very top.
No, you're absolutely right. And I mean, it is amazing to me how ahistorical I think most commentators are on these kinds of issues. I mean, we were just talking about the Middle East, but if you really want to understand that process, you have to go back to World War II, pre-World War II, to get kind of an understanding for that. And here, when we're talking about North and South Korea, I mean, we're talking about Eisenhower forward, you know, so the things that have been set up are now kind of playing out. And you're right, even if you make changes now, their effects will not be felt in a matter of days or months. They're going to be measured on years, and they always are.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, as we kind of wrap up our foreign policy, we're going to kind of start heading back, talking about some more domestic policy. And the first is that this week, the first woman to ever lead the CIA and the first career CIA officer to lead the agency since the 1970s, Gina Haspel, was confirmed on Thursday despite controversy surrounding her role in waterboarding and other torture programs. The vote, 54-45, includes Democratic votes. In fact, it was necessary for that to happen because you had a number of Republicans who defected, including Rand Paul of Kentucky and Jeff Flake of Arizona. Why the controversy? Two major reasons. One was in 2002 when she ran a black site prison in Thailand where officers carried out waterboarding and other harsh tactics. And when we say harsh, we're talking about some nasty things. On suspected Al-Qaeda militants. The other was in 2005 when she was based at CIA headquarters outside Washington and wrote a cable calling for videotapes of that torture to be destroyed. And so that has been the crux of the question and the issue. So, Michael, what do you make about this appointment, and what do you think about this issue on the torture front?
Well, as I said last week, I stand with Senator McCain on this. I think that her involvement, what we know about her involvement in this, is disqualifying. I certainly believe that she is qualified in every other way. And this is, again, to me, yet another example of the Trump administration being sort of, I would call it, intentionally provocative when it comes to these things. You know, we just talked about it a little bit ago. There are certainly, you know, there's a tradition of CIA directors coming from outside of the agency, like, for instance, Mike Pompeo and so forth. So I think given the history of the CIA, the recent history of the CIA with this, one would hope that you would find certainly a qualified candidate who wouldn't have that connection. And that clearly did not seem to be a concern to the Trump administration. And I think that's a mistake. It sends a message. And I think that's a negative message. Now, again, I think that Gina Haspel is going to do a great job. I think she saved her nomination she didn't repudiate the torture, but she did say that the program damaged our officers and our standing in the world, which is a very different thing than saying that it was immoral or wrong, just damaging. And for me, that wouldn't have been enough, but it apparently was enough for, you know, about what I think was six Democrats, mm-hmm. right? Donnelly, Heitkamp, Manchin, the standard group of, conservative Democrats who are kind of imperiled and so forth. So I disagree, but I could see where it would be sort of a close call. But I'm with McCain, Flake, and Rand Paul on this, which is not something I necessarily say a lot.
Well, yeah, and one of the things, I mean, she will actually end up writing a letter later on saying, quote, "With the benefit of hindsight and my experience as a senior agency leader, the enhanced interrogation program is not one the CIA should have undertaken," end quote. And that's what the Democratic senators would point to when they would say that they could vote for her. But I'm, you know, on this one, you know, before the show, we'd even kind of talked about this. I think we're going to probably have a lot of agreement. This is absolutely and unquestionably a mistake. And you know, you had said that, you know, in every other way she's qualified, and you know, I mean, I agree in one sense, but the issue here is so unqualifying. I mean, we're talking about somebody who not only tortured people, let's call it for what it is. She then wanted to get rid of the evidence and the historical record of that torture. So, do we really want to trust the person who says, you know what, when we make a mistake, we ditch the tapes? I mean, so for me, I think that, you know, you can have a moment where everybody makes issues, or you think that you're on the right side of history and you're not. So even if we grant her look, enhanced interrogation techniques, i.e., torture, might be necessary in this circumstance. The thing that I simply, as an analyst and as a moral human being, cannot let her off the hook for is then later, you know, 3 years later, saying, well, you know what we got to do now is obviously you know this was wrong. Otherwise, you wouldn't be asking for these tapes to be destroyed. And the idea that you're trying to, you know, save those people, you know, her point is basically, you know, somebody's going to find out about it and have retaliation. Well, then maybe you shouldn't have been torturing people in the first place. Anyway, so I probably have a slightly stronger stance on this one. I find it a little repugnant that Democrats were willing to cross over. This is one where this should be an easy win for Democrats to say, look, I'm in a tough district, but no, I don't vote yes for torture, because this will come back and haunt them.
I think, well, I don't know, unfortunately, if it's going to actually come back and haunt them. I'd like to think so, but again, I think it was just morally the wrong thing to do. But even though, I mean, I think she'll end up doing a fine job as CIA director. I have no question about her general qualifications, but I just think this was not a policy vote. This wouldn't have been a policy vote for me. This is a morals vote for me, and that's why I would have voted against it if I had the opportunity.
I understand. I'm with you, but you know, and you're probably right. But it's just difficult for me to say that I'd ever be able to give her record credence, given that the woman who wanted to get rid of things is now going to be the one who just makes that decision. So how do we know what she ends up doing? It taints, in my opinion, whatever she ends up doing, because can we believe it?
I totally understand.
So, well. Additional, still in the Senate, but on a different issue, we're going to move to talking about the Senate Intel Committee report on Russia and Trump. And it doesn't look really great for Trump. Basically, Republican and Democratic leaders on the Senate Intelligence Committee on Wednesday endorsed the U.S. intelligence community's assessment that Russia had intervened in the 2016 presidential election, specifically to help Donald Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton. It's a powerful bipartisan endorsement of a conclusion that has been called into question in the House, and who have argued that this is just a bunch of hooey, including from Trump himself repeatedly, as we were talking about earlier on Twitter. So, what do you think about this? Does it really change anything? Is this important? What do you think, Michael?
I don't think it changes anything. I mean, it fits a broader pattern. What we've seen this not just in this administration, but for decades in the past, that when it comes to investigating these things, the Senate tends to be, I would say, a lot more serious, a lot less partisan than the House, because of course the House Intel Committee came out with their conclusion that Russia simply tried to subvert the process and didn't really have any preference in terms of a candidate. And the Senate's report, you know, agrees with the intelligence community, and they published that finding, I believe it was in January of 2017. But this is something obviously that the president himself is loath to admit. But the evidence seems to be fairly strong, and I wish this had more. You know, I wish this would be more believable to people who don't already believe it. But given the lengths to which the Trump administration and Trump supporters have gone to basically destroy the credibility of anyone who would challenge their narrative, I just don't see that as being something that would happen. And that, to me, is the more deeply troubling thing. I don't think there's anything wrong with pushing back hard, even against conclusions. In fact, I would be concerned if the administration didn't do that or the opposition party didn't do that. Where I draw the line is that immediately going to this is simply not credible. Let's argue on the facts. Yes, absolutely. But when you get into this idea of motives and that there is, and I know we're going to get into this in a little bit, but get into this whole deep state conspiracy sort of thing, that's when I think you're getting into incredibly dangerous territory. And this has been, from the beginning, led by the president, who I don't think gives a damn about the health and respect and legitimacy of institutions. He cares fundamentally, first of all, about protecting Donald Trump. He's no patriot. He's an amazing narcissistic egomaniac who, regardless of what he may accomplish for various conservative goals, if you're a conservative, is a disaster as a president of the United States for that reason alone.
Well, it is fascinating because this is an example of where if you had a slightly better White House staff, which would only be possible if you have a slightly different head of your White House. So you have this conclusion. Well, as Jay and I and you, Jay, have talked about in the past, the likelihood that this influence, which has obviously happened, right? Let's just put that out there. The thing that seems to be getting conflated is, did this happen with, is the outcome of the election a direct cause of the Russian interference?
Right.
And I think the answer to that question is probably clearly no. And so I think it's fascinating about this is, I mean, why continue to pointlessly try to deny the fact that Russia, of course Russia's been, they've done this before. They just weren't maybe quite as good at it, or as a result of having a different kind of media environment, they've been more effective at it. But even being more effective doesn't mean that Donald Trump was elected because of Russia. And I think that's the argument that the White House needs to make, is to say, yeah, of course Russia's been involved. This is the kind of games that Russia plays all the time. And instead of taking that track, they're doing exactly what you're saying, which is dragging a bunch of people through the mud pointlessly. And by so doing, it makes it look like that they believe the only reason they won is because of Russia. And to a partially informed observer, what that hints at is to say, oh, wait a second, you know this is the reason. Now, I think in honesty, I think this is just bungled handling by the White House. I don't think that, you know, that was the cause, but that is the appearance. And appearance is everything here.
Well, and I think there certainly has been some bungled handling, but I think that this comes from, I would argue, just an element of the president's, if you want to call it psychology, the idea that throughout his career, he has believed in never letting any shot go unanswered, he likes to call himself a counterpuncher, right? And so the idea that there's anything that anyone could even see as potentially tainting and he would just let it be is just totally goes against what we've seen from him, not just as president, but in his entire adult life. And as we all know, sometimes the best approach to claims is to not give them the air and the publicity, and they kind of die on their own by simply doing the sort of thing you suggested. But that, is in my estimation, is just not in the president's psyche. He can't let things be when letting something be would have made it look a lot less suspicious, as you say. And so to me, this is just a psychological quirk, if you will, of the president, in which case, you know, and that he's really kind of shooting himself in the foot in this. And we can see this in a lot of other ways, too, I would argue. I mean, think about what would happen if he hadn't fired, you know, Jim Comey, for instance, which I think was connected in the same thing. So he talks about this as being a huge witch hunt. We'll get into that, I know, in a little bit here, probably. But part of it he's brought on himself by being so incredibly his approach, which has been so incredibly combative, and I think that's been a big mistake from the beginning.
Yes, and it's fascinating to me that the president just continues to equate the idea that Russia wants to be involved with something with his legitimacy. I mean, and that is just, I mean, and again, that makes the point that your assumption, meaning, you know, from Donald Trump's point of view, that you recognize that you're the reason this is happening. that is what just.
Well, I'm very suspicious of this whole psychological profiling at a distance sort of thing, which we've seen so much of with President Trump. And obviously,
we've always done it with presidents. Yeah. I mean, all the way back to Barbara. Go ahead. Sorry.
You're right. But I think, you know, if you believe in that sort of thing, you say, well, if you look at President Donald Trump throughout his career, he certainly gives off the feeling of being a deeply, deeply insecure man who is desperate to show that he is big and tough and so forth. I mean, this is not what a truly self-confident person does. This is what somebody who's compensating does. And again, not just as president, but throughout his career. And I would argue that the last sort of person you want to be the most powerful person in the world is a deeply insecure person, which I certainly think there's a reason to think that that is what Donald Trump is, deeply insecure.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's difficult sometimes, you know, as you're doing the show prep and we get ready for these kinds of conversations to not try to have those psychological insights, because you kind of get this running stream of consciousness on Twitter. As a matter of fact, I've tried very carefully to not just constantly have our shows and we have these kind of conversations be the, you know, how did Donald Trump respond on Twitter show?
Yeah.
But, you know,
I actually thought that we should maybe do like a separate spinoff show called like Trump Tweets or something like that, where we just talk about that.
Yeah. Maybe that should be the new part of the new bonus show for listeners. We could read Donald Trump's tweets and analyze them in crazy voices.
Oh, I don't know if I could handle that, Trey. That might be a bridge too far, but an interesting idea. Anyway, sorry, I just wanted to mention that.
Well, on that front, talking about the bonus show, would you like to kind of – I know that we had some listeners support and other things going on.
I almost forgot about that. Thank you for reminding me. You know, last week I mentioned to listeners that we were starting a special bonus show, just, you know, 10, 15 minutes for our supporters, and Jay and I last week we talked about H.L. Mencken and his view of blockheads. I love that word. We talked about Oliver North being new NRA president, the Republicans, and the whole Senate blue strip. No, that's a Trump slip of the tongue there. Blue slip tradition and judicial nominations and a couple other things, but it was a lot of fun. Supporters got a chance to listen to that sort of thing. And people really responded to that. In this last week on Patreon, we had Tanner, Chris, Rachel, Justin, Lane, Christopher, and Amanda, all new monthly sustaining supporters on Patreon. Thank you guys so very much. That's awesome how you responded. And I should also mention that a number of our current our past Patreon supporters upped their pledges again. Kat, who, that's the second time Kat's upped her pledge. Thank you. David and Dustin. And we also have a new monthly sustaining supporter on PayPal. You can do that. Christopher. So it was a great response, folks. And that is definitely helping us, because, of course, as I mentioned, we want to keep the show ad free at where we're at. That's not possible right now, but if folks keep on responding like that, I think that's going to be a real possibility, and that will be just awesome. That's what we want too. But before we move on, I should mention that Christopher, one of our new Patreon sustaining supporters, he wrote in to say, thank you for your note telling me about the lack of support on Patreon. As someone who was unhappy with the often 2+ minute ads, and we did tend to go on that, that's mostly me, I told myself that I'd become a contributor when you became ad-free. Due to being forgetful and only remembering I should be signing up when I'm driving, because that's largely when I listen, it's taken me quite some time. However, your recent announcement made it stick in my head, so thank you for that. To repeat what almost everyone always says, thanks for your fair and balanced show and helping me keep informed with a more in-depth debate and conversation. Well, thanks very much, Christopher. We really appreciate it. And like I said, to everyone, that was awesome. And you all know, if you're a regular listener, if you want to support the show, politicsguys.com/support, or just go to politicsguys.com and you'll see the Patreon and PayPal links are in the menu there. We would really appreciate it. We love keeping the show ad-free. We want to continue that. And also, we think the bonus show is kind of a great little thing that you should enjoy. And so there you go. All right.
Well, wonderful. And, you know, we all really appreciate those ups and supports. So, but as we move forward, we want to talk a little bit related to that Senate Intel Committee, Michael, was that We have a bunch of Trump Tower documents released by the Senate Judiciary Committee. And let me just say, I have been looking through the material, and there is a lot of it. So, I mean, just to put this in perspective, there is about 2,500 pages of documents. That's more than I make my students read an entire semester.
Yeah, no kidding.
So I just want to point that out because, you know, while I have been poring over this, I know that Michael's been looking at this. There's obviously more here than what we can analyze in a few days. But there are some interesting, there are some big interesting tidbits that are already coming out that all of us have been able to kind of take a look at. So Michael, what are the ones that stuck out to you?
Well, I'm trying to, I guess, pull back and sort of say, well, what does this tell me more generally? What we know? And it seems to me that the main thing is something I already suspected, is that Donald Jr. was trying to get in pretty deep with the Russians. Now, I don't think there's any smoking guns there. I certainly haven't seen anything like that. So I would say, from what I've been able to get, that not just Donald Trump Jr., but a number of people connected with the Trump campaign were understandably interested in getting dirt on Hillary Clinton and helping Donald Trump win the presidency. I get that. But I think that a lot of things they did were certainly ill-advised and certainly unethical. I don't know if they went so far as actually illegal. To me, again, you know, there's that old quote from Napoleon that's something about don't attribute to malice what you can more easily attribute to incompetence or something like that. And I think there's part of that there. You know, I certainly think there are some nefarious people surrounding Donald Trump. I mean, heck, the guy's a real estate developer. I mean, you know, but anyway, I think mostly it's a lot of people who are just clueless about how these things work. And it's understood among people who've been in politics at this level that you don't actively solicit information from people connected to a hostile foreign power, at least not in the way that they did it. So I always kind of default to that, you know, the kind of more clueless, incompetent rather than evil kind of thing. You know, I think that works both ways, though, Trey, because, of course, the counter narrative from President Trump and people on the right is that there's this deep state FBI intelligence community conspiracy to break the law, to basically take down Donald Trump, candidate Trump, and then President Trump, which, you know, started with the campaign. And we see this, you know, further and further with this whole how it's amazing to me how, for instance, the left and the right are dramatically different in their interpretation of this Crossfire Hurricane codename operation, basically. I mean, you know, the left is saying, well, it seems based on our reporting, what we've learned, that the FBI actually was being really sort of hands off in their investigation when they, even though they thought that there was a potential of this, you know, serious connection between a hostile foreign power and a campaign, but they didn't want to sway the election, basically. And then the right saying, no, you're missing it. They had no reason to investigate in the first place, and they used this counterterrorism sort of pretext so they could go after this president who they hated, basically. And it's just a fascinating thing to read these entirely different narratives based on the same set of, I won't even call them facts, because all we're getting is, you know, largely, well, to this point, it's been leaks. And then in these thousands of pages of information, certainly we're seeing both sides cherry pick like crazy the sort of things that ties into their confirmation bias.
Well, and that's one of the problems when you have something this massive and you're already having news reports on it. I mean, I defy anybody who was originally reading these documents to say that they had read all, you know, all the pages before we were reporting on it. And I think that's one of the problems. And so you're right. You end up having this kind of cherry pick. You know, the things that are interesting to me, and I think from what I can tell, again, I have not read all, I'm not going to claim I've read all 2,500 pages yet, but I'm working on it, is that as you were pointing out a little bit earlier, and then we kind of moved on, was I think Trump Jr. here has had obviously some shady connections at best. Now, illegal, that's a different, that's an entirely different question. But it is clear that he is emailing with and asking for and saying, look, I love it. If you have this stuff for me, I'll take it, is basically what he's saying. Now, he has a very different view on what that means than kind of its plain sense meaning. But these kind of multiple meetings, these emails, it appears in many ways that Trump Jr. was out on a fishing expedition and he didn't care. He wasn't thinking very carefully about how he was going on that expedition. And so even though he doesn't really net anything, he now ends up looking really bad because, why are you on the fishing expedition with these kinds of people? That's I think, fundamentally the problem.
Absolutely. And, I should point out on the other side of things, I think I certainly have no problem believing that there were and that there still are some very strongly anti-Trump FBI and intelligence community people. I mean, we saw that in the Strozek email or texts and so forth. So, yeah. But going from that to claiming that these people broke the law with no corroborating evidence, I mean, that's incredibly irresponsible, throwing out words like treason, as the president has done. And, if this seems serious enough to Congress— I'm not trying to brush this under the rug. They should absolutely investigate, I think. If it seems serious enough to, for instance, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, he should appoint a special counsel. I would certainly be for that. Or if there, there could be a Department of Justice Inspector General investigation, like there is, by the way, for the Clinton email investigation. And I should point out that investigation has been going on for 17 months. It's still going on. They say it's going to be coming to a close soon. That's compared to just over a year for Mueller's investigation, and everyone's screaming about how Mueller's investigation is taking too long. Well, these things take time. You can't rush this sort of thing unless you want to rush to judgment. So I want to be clear to folks on the right who are listening to this, and Scott, you know who you are. I'm talking to you in particular. With everyone, I'm not trying to brush things under the rug. If there is any sort of credible evidence that President Obama's administration illegally or unethically spied on Donald Trump, I want to get to the bottom of that because that is incredibly serious. So, but I think that, again, also this kind of has put the FBI in a bad position from the beginning. And this is what happens when your two major party nominees for president are incredibly ethically challenged people, I think. The FBI was not designed to kind of deal with this sort of thing, I think, is another thing that I think.
No, it's true. And I think, and the other thing that I think comes out of this, and that I don't really have, and I'm not sure there's much more to be said, is that this goes back again to this question of, I think a lot of people are uncomfortable with Congress and the modern age. We live in the presidential age, but I mean, one of Congress's roles is to debate and investigate things, and it's time consuming. It can be boring at times, but that's what you have to have happen if you want to know things, if you want to come to conclusions. And one of the problems of the modern American political system is it's become too directive and presidential centered, in my opinion.
Amen.
And as a result, we look at things like a long investigation. I'm putting long in quotation marks. I agree with you. A long investigation or a big discussion on some issue as a bad thing. And it's not. I mean, as a matter of fact, we should want that.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And, one final thing I wanted to get in there before we move on is the one issue I have with these competing narratives, or this is how I'm kind of looking at it, is it seems to me that the only way the narrative on the right holds up is that if you think almost everyone involved in all these investigations in the FBI, the CIA, all these people, that they're essentially, well, corrupt. Because, it's one thing to say, well, you have personal preferences, but saying that you would take those and subvert the law to, make those preferences come out in the reality, that seems to me to be like a huge stretch. And so that's why I have problems believing this deep state conspiracy sort of thing, because it just seems to be too much, essentially. I have a lot easier time believing that the president and the people close to him are corrupt, because that's not because of anything about Donald Trump. I mean, specifically, well, that's a whole other story, but because it's a smaller number of people, you know? And so I find that to be more plausible, whether it would be a Democrat or a Republican, I think. But anyway.
Well, no, it's absolutely true what you're saying. I mean, the problem of conspiracy theories is most of the time, for them to be effective, the number of moving parts that have to work together are just statistically unlikely. And so what you're saying is like, yeah, sure, I can roll 1,000 dice and they can all come up with a one, but that's not as likely as rolling 3 dice and having them all come up as a one.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as we finish up the show, Michael, why don't we talk about what we've been reading? As you know, I'm a book guy. I know, you know, if you like books. So this week, I just finished a book called Endure: Mind, Body, and Curious, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. For listeners, you may or may not know about this, me, but I am a kind of a dedicated distance runner who trains for half marathons and marathons and tries. And I know I'm crazy.
Yeah, I say that.
But I find a lot of peace in that. And Endure, in this book by Alex Hutchinson, what he's looking at, it is fascinating. Even if you don't want to do running like me, it's not a running book. It's actually about the connections between how you think about things and the absolute physical limits of your body. And what's fascinating is that basically we rarely come to the absolute physical limits of our body, not because we don't want to, because like baked into our brain are these fail-safe switches and how you can kind of manipulate on those. It's a really, really fascinating read. And so if you need a little break from politics and you're curious about physiology and food and like what can humans do, this is a really great book for you. And it's a quick read. It's a lot of fun. And so I recommend Endure this week by Hutchinson.
Oh, wow, that sounds really interesting. I might have to check that out. My recommendation this week is an article from Wired by Robert Wright, who's a fascinating guy. He not too long ago wrote a book called Why Buddhism is True, and that's kind of a provocative title. It's a great book, too. But this article is called Sam Harris and the Myth of Perfectly Rational Thought. Now, listeners know I've recommended a number of episodes of Sam Harris's Waking Up podcast. Not like he needs my recommendation. You know, Sam Harris is huge, right? But I love Sam Harris in so many ways. But the one thing that annoys me about him, especially because he comes at things kind of from my left of center sort of rationalist viewpoint, is how he is so blind to his own cognitive biases and shortfalls and so forth. And it's this kind of arrogance that I've seen, not just from Sam Harris, but kind of from what you call the new atheists and those sort of people, that we have all the answers. We are certainly right. Everyone else is sort of kind of an idiot or superstitious or that sort of thing. And that's always bugged me, because I think one of the things that we're lacking in this society, so many things we're lacking, but one is a certain humility, just in general humility, not like false humility, but real intellectual humility, the ability to do the hard work of saying, okay, here's what I think. I think it's very evidence-based, but I'm going to try really hard to consider if I might be wrong. And that's hard work to do. It's difficult to do. I think a lot of people play at it, but they don't do a really good job at it. And I understand why, but you know, we're all subject to cognitive biases, and being smart has nothing to do with that. There've been plenty of research that shows that there's no relationship between that. In fact, sometimes smarter people can have even worse cognitive biases in certain areas. And so I think it's a great article to read, regardless of what you think about Sam Harris. It kind of really talks about some of these biases that we have and how baked in they are to us evolution and from an evolutionary standpoint and so forth. And, you know, I think it struck a chord with me because, of course, one of the things we try to do on the show is to do the hard work of not just presenting our positions, but trying to listen to the other person and consider their positions. That's really difficult to do, but I think there's such a great need for that in our society. And I think this article fits right in with that. And so I would recommend that. Again, Sam Harris and the Myth of perfectly Rational Thought in Wired magazine.
Oh, that's fascinating. And I love Wired. So, Well, Michael, I appreciate that. That is it for this week's episode, listeners. I'd like to thank you, and I hope that you like what you heard. Listeners can head to politicsguys.com/support or head to politicsguys.com and click on support to help support this show and to continue to keep it ad-free. So please head to politicsguys.com/support. You can also help us by subscribing, by sharing episodes with your friends. Please rate us on iTunes if you can. That helps us in so many ways. If you would like to interact with us, as always, you can hit us up at mail@politicsguys.com. Or for the ongoing discussion almost every day at facebook.com/politicsguys, where Mike, myself, and Jay are constantly responding to you and sharing some really fascinating things. Or you can always follow us on Twitter @politicsguys. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Trey Orndorff, and Bruce Johnson. This episode is produced by Trey Orndorff. We have a new show on Wednesday. We hope you'll join us then.